My uncle got this Guernsey calf, a heifer, which is very hard to get. They don't give away heifers.
You and Celia?
Yeah.
In where?
In Missouri, yeah.
Wow.
In Rocheport, Missouri, yeah.
Exciting.
For 2 years, yeah. I just finished building the house, and then we, people thought we were nuts, you know, and then we left, right? Well, we got, you know, that was back to the land times.
Right.
You know, my sister.
In your mind, do you want
Well, what happened was George Mintz had owned all of Pear Valley.
Right.
And he moved here in the late, you know, maybe 60, maybe 70, something in that period. Mm-hmm. And we got to be, he got a little, he was working for Don McQueen. So we got to know one another and we got really bonded. And he and his wife, he had farmed on a farm in Michigan, kind of romantic idea, really diversified farm. They did everything and he wanted to do that. So they wanted to go back and do that. And we were going to go with him. And then that kind of fell through. My sister and her husband were, she was a teacher at Oakland Tech and he was a anthropology guy. So they moved back to Missouri. So we just came along with them because my uncle had farms and I farmed when I was a kid. That's one reason I like being outside.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that didn't work out because we would have had to sell this place, you know, in order to really make it long-lasting, and that was too big a bite, so fortunately, because then it was maybe, I don't know, 19,000 or something. It wasn't worth it. Yeah, so Jeannie and Arden were in Oregon, and there was a little farm next to them, and this lady had cows, and so Arden kind of thought she might want to sell her farm. We didn't want to give up the cows, so we put in the back of a gooseneck trailer with all our stuff, and slowly drove the Datsun with our sheepdog and I drove the truck and trailer, and the cow was in the back. And we stopped and milked the cow.
how long?
Yeah, and then, you know, we the funny thing, I mean, there's stories about that, but one night we slept in a motel and we parked outside in a parking lot where the lights were on. In the middle of the night, you hear this, moo, moo. So I was in a motel parking lot, so I had to get out and cover the truck.
Right.
So the cow wouldn't move.
So how long of a trip was it? How many days did it take you?
Gosh, what is it? It's got to be 3 days at least.
Yeah.
From Missouri to Ashland, Oregon.
Right. And then what happened?
So Arden was married to Jeannie.
Uh-huh.
And they had two daughters, yeah.
Okay.
Amber, I mean, Helen and, I think of it, August.
Okay. Yeah. So where are you born?
L.A., Hollywood.
Hollywood
Presbyterian, you know the hospital that got hacked.
Okay. That's where you're born.
Yeah.
And your parents lived there then?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But you say you farmed as a kid.
My mother's sister, they're from the Missouri area. My mother's sister was married a man that was an investor, and he had farms, and he, when I was a kid, when I was in junior high school and high school, I'd go back there and farm for summers. I loved it.
I see, for the summers.
I loved it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But your childhood was basically...
I love sweat. I love working with it. I mean, I loved it. I just loved the work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird. I mean, he had another nephew there who, when we were hoeing weeds on the corn between the corn rows, I'd find him asleep between the rows. He's a banker now,
right,
anyway.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Not for him.
Wow. So this is a summer job, basically, that you had as a kid.
Yeah, something to do. Well, yeah. Especially when I was in junior high school, was it? You know?
Right.
Yeah, I get the right.
So your parents then were living in Los Angeles. You and you had siblings.
They
right?
moved there. Yeah, my sister.
Uh-huh.
No, they moved there in the 30s.
Okay.
Early 30s, yeah.
And where did they come from?
Missouri.
Okay.
Yeah, his folks were in Kansas City.
Okay.
And she had relatives in Missouri. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's unravel the mystery of Ray Sanborn then by starting. But let's start in L.A. Then. What you went to school? You went to high school there,
uh-huh.
and then what happens after your schooling is done, or anything during high school that you feel like mentioning about as a child, as a young teenager? How was it in L.A.?
Well, I was very fortunate. Both my sister and I, you know, feel like we were really lucky. We went to high school. We went to. It was not that this is not, it was 90% Jewish. That doesn't mean anything in that sense, except that it was very academically focused. I mean, you were as much admired for how you did academically as you were on a football field sort
right.
of thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah.
So you have fond memories from high school?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then after high school, what happened?
Oh, I went to Santa Barbara.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what did you do in Santa Barbara?
Well,
talk about
college.
Santa Barbara.
I was in college, yeah, uh-huh. UCSB. Yeah.
Okay. And what did you study there?
I was a religious studies minor and a sociology major. So
okay.
I was really interested in religion. I'd been active in the church.
Uh-huh.
And while I was there, I was lucky because Paul Tillich came there. I was very uh-huh. much into all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I went to his lectures, took his class.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah.
What church?
That was very lucky.
What church?
Congregational.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you still?
Quite the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
The values are there, but the dogma is not.
Right, right.
Yeah, very much not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, you know, Fritz has a painting of Christ bringing death and destruction to the world.
Right.
You know, because of what that religion has done to the human potential.
Yeah, right.
You know.
And then not just
so
that.
Through the feelings of guilt, you know, feelings that somebody's judging you and all this stuff that just robs you of your.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Uh-huh.
But that's not what that's not what Tillich was talking about. So.
No, right. But it was a sense of a spiritual quest you had as a young man then.
Well, I don't know, I was interested in that stuff. My father was he wrote a thesis for to get his PhD in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up not following through on that, ended up in journalism, but the interest has always been there in all those ideas. I loved ideas, you know, I loved all that stuff.
Yeah.
Read all that. And and UC Santa Barbara had a religious studies, it's the only secular religious studies class, major,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that the other schools didn't have either.
Right.
I didn't go there because of that, but that's, so I was more interested in that than I was in sociology, probably.
Yeah. So the religious studies were across the board, pretty much all religions, in a sense, were involved in
those
studies. You know?
Oh, yeah, no,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, who's, yeah.
Uh-huh. So
but you know, those days you're reading all that stuff. You know,
all about the Hinduism.
Existentialism,
Buddhism,
Sartre,
and
Bard, and all these guys. Yeah.
Philosophies, yeah.
I was really into it.
Okay.
I loved it, yeah.
Yeah. And did you think then at that time, did you think that you were going to work in that field? Were you hoping?
I think maybe during that time I was still thinking about. I had the minister that I and church that I was involved in. He was a great liberal, wonderful man. He was a Marine in World War II, and he we used to kid him about it, but not just the, you know, about being maybe rough.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But anyway, yeah, and so he was off. I wrote, he and I corresponded a lot when I was in college about stuff, and so did my dad and I, and so on all these issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, that were raised. And so at one point I did think I was might go into the ministry. I even looked, went to, when I was on tour back east, I kind of checked out Yale Divinity School, and
mm-hmm.
yeah,
wow.
But
that
was them.
So, that sounds so nice, though. I mean, it's heartwarming in a way. I mean, for you to mention that you had correspondence, and I guess maybe not correspondence, but over the telephone in those days or something.
Written letters.
With your father?
Written letters,
yeah. That's a wonderful
between
thing.
Between him and, yeah.
Yeah.
He was interested in all this. He's very, yeah, he was great.
And interested in communicating with you about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He'd love to sit down and kind of, you know, think about an issue and write, you know, the pluses and minuses, and that was his. Yeah, he loved that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
No, he died. Gosh, when Walt, same year Walter died.
Oh,
89, 90.
Yeah.
He was born in 1910, so he was 79.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey Zeke, you have to lay down. Okay, and you stay there now. Okay, we're just gonna have a chat. there's so many things I'd like to talk about, actually, but we are going to bring this to.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions for you.
but I want to know first of all, of course, then, or not first of all, but because of what we're trying to do here is talk about your life and here in Big Sur, or the
mm-hmm.
relationship to this place.
Mm-hmm.
So then, do you remember when you first heard of Big Sur?
Very clearly, actually. I was at Santa Barbara. I'd already been admitted to the University of Michigan in the School of Social Work and as graduate. And I took my elective educational psych class. And it was taught by George Brown. It was like four of us in the class. Well, he turns out was on the board of Esalen in the beginning. He was one of the board members. And so he bragged, well, bragged, he talked about Fritz Perls. And so I was writing a paper on it, and so I got in the seminar and came up here and to a weekend seminar. And what do they say? And the rest is history.
Right, right, of course. Yeah, yeah. So that's Esalen.
Yeah. I got very turned on by it. Partly because I think my world was sheltered in some ways. I never seen people kind of act out, or, you know, it was more, I was maybe academic, but you know, he had the I'll never forget the first night, and he had this lady tell a dream where she was kind of a, show that she's kind of a weak person and a strong person. He pointed that out, and so he got her to be these two people, it just blew me away. Because you could tell she really was. This was really her. Right. She really had this split in her personality, this bully and this meek person. Uh-huh.
Right. So you had been coming from a more reserved place.
So, yeah, and more, and he was very much, and I questioned my own other directedness. You know, you study about that, and you can intellectualize about it. But I saw how a lot of what I did was in that other directing, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What about what people think of what you're doing? You learn to do that. You learn how to get good grades. Not always, anyway.
Right.
So, and he was more for, you know, the getting past the role playing into being a real person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I got very excited about that. Yeah. I went back to Michigan, and you know, that was. They thought Esalen was
something really far out and crazy. Yeah,
we didn't get along too well.
Yeah.
I went out. I was very idealistic and very turned on. So they sent me out to Detroit, this area services, for field work. And I'll never forget. I went to this office of this. It was this guy. There's a black in the black community. And he had all these plaques on the wall about things he'd accomplished. And you know, they went out and painted houses. And I thought it was all crap. This is not what people want.
No,
it's right. Not. It's not what they mean. You know, it doesn't give them meaning. I'm more into meaning, right?
Right.
So, I didn't last there. So then they kicked me up to a Catholic guy who was great in Lansing, and I worked with them, and I liked that. But I'll tell you one experience I had that. There's one night we're in this kitchen. Cesar Chavez was there, and about, I don't know, six, eight people.
Where are we?
In Lansing, in Michigan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the communal feeling in that room was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, they're flipping tortillas and they're talking. There's just a real fellowship going on.
Right.
That our middle class didn't have. You know, that, you know, we'd sit at a table and we'd do this, but we just didn't have that. And I felt, gosh, you know, how, I can't, here I am trying to do, you know, social work help when they got something that's pretty valuable, and then I'm in a, but they want what we have,
right?
More money,
right.
But I'm not in a position to tell them, no, wait a minute, right?
Yeah,
it's really startling.
So Chavez was there for a political rally movement.
I don't remember. But I do remember that.
Right.
It kind of surprised me. It's such a small group. Yeah.
So how old were you then when you got to Esalen, to the first workshop with Chris?
67. Let's see. Did it all happen in 67? No, I moved. Probably did. Mm-hmm. Because I graduated in February of 67 from Santa Barbara, and that was the last year, so I probably went to, in January I probably went up to Esalen maybe in 67, something like that. It's 22.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A wild and crazy summer.
Yeah.
Did you feel it? Did you know it? You must have, of course.
Well, no, what happened then was I went back to Michigan, and it's another thing in Michigan that I'll never forget either, and that was I went to the City Hall. This is before in 67 when I was with the Area Services, and they had this whole big meeting about what to do about race relations and everything, and then that summer they had the riots.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do.
Right. Who do you mean they didn't know?
All the people are in this, all the mucky mucks that are in this big room trying to
figure out something.
Yeah. At least it didn't seem like it. Well, it turned out they didn't because it happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, so when I was at Michigan, it's nothing. I had started, I had a sociology professor who actually got me going to Michigan, and he was very socially conscious, just like I was, you know, doing community things. Because I had started a coffee house in Isla Vista for folk music. People came and played folk music. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we used to go down to Topanga Canyon, I think. They had a big folk festival down there. We'd go down there. And I saw guys that played the banjo and all that. So we had coffee, and it was in the basement of a church building, I think. It was in Isla Vista. So he got to know me, so he started this Communitas organization to bridge the gap between professors and students, that, you know, the communication gap, they talk above the students' heads, sort of. So mm-hmm. he thought maybe organized meetings at professors' houses, students gathered. Anyway, so we did all that. So he's the one that got me to go to Michigan, but he's a Quaker, and also helped, and I participated and helped, started a silent vigil against the war Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And we'd stand in front of the library for an hour, you know, and do a vigil against the war, right? So I went to Michigan, I started the same thing in Michigan. Well, this is February, and January, right? Well, February, late February, right? This is the third quarter weather is, and it's 20 degrees. And there's three of us out there. It was the SDS. I went to an SDS meeting there, and they're talking about blowing things up and doing these things, and I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, there's could be agents in here. So the vigil wasn't much of a statement compared to what they were doing.
So how did you avoid the draft yourself?
I had a student deferment. Until then I dropped out of that and went to, and then, no, I refused induction. I had a lawyer. I actually refused three times, actually. Once I actually have to go up there and say no and not stand forward, and they give you all this stuff, you know, this talk about how terrible it's going to be for you and all that.
Right.
It's really an irony, though. You know, my roommate, and I was in ROTC at UCSB. Uh-huh. My sister had a boyfriend that was in ROTC. So I just, my roommate went to Vietnam. Mm. And I think it was, at that time, it was such a fine line between where you came out on that. Mm-hmm. Such a fine line, because he went and I didn't, sort of, and I ended up a protester, and he... You know, and that why that happened was the professor's house that I was staying at. They became close friends, and Ira Sampro came to his house with Joan Baez to give a talk about nonviolence and peace and the war and everything, and they invited me there, and so that turned I bought the argument. I couldn't turn my head for those things. So anyway, So that's how I ended up in Santa Barbara, and at Michigan. But then by the time I got there, I was already done for. So I came back, dropped out. I took one quarter, and I came back and applied to Esalen's residential program.
68 then.
No, it's still 67.
Still 67.
Okay. Yeah, it was all in 67.
All of it. And then you're at the residential program at Esalen.
And there was 200 people there. I don't know, there was a whole lot of people wanted to get in on that program at that time.
Yeah. And you were happily weeding the gardens and cleaning.
No. I just applied. I went back to LA and I went to the application process. And went back to LA for the summer to work. At first I wasn't accepted.
Right.
And at the end of the summer they had someone drop out and they called me up.
And then you came up here and started Esalen.
Yeah, the residential program. The idea then was, you know, the week seminars aren't long lasting enough. So maybe if you have a residential program, it'll last.
So what did you do then at Esalen at that time? What was your daily routine like?
Well, we had the residential program. There would be, I think we made it 18 of us, something like that, or 15. And we had a leader, and we had our own encounter groups, and then we'd go. We participate in the seminars that came through.
Whatever you wanted to, kind of.
I don't remember having a choice. I think the ones that came through.
Right.
We worked with Fritz, and we worked with the body Bertie Gunther, and I mean, I can't remember all the people.
Yeah.
But we had all of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Plus being part of the community.
Right.
You know, the whole.
How was it?
Talk
about it. Talk about it a little bit. The scene. What was the scene like?
Well, for me, I wouldn't trade for anything. I mean, other people might reflect differently, but
yeah.
I was just lucky to be there at that age, at that time, with all that going on. Yeah.
Yeah,
I wouldn't trade for anything. Yeah, I was. I was.
Can you put words to some of the reasons that you loved it so much? Can you think about, talk about, you know, if you think back on it and you, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon on one of those days at SLN, you look around yourself and you feel like this is so great. What was it about it that was so great? For you, just for you.
Gosh, that's hard to say. I'd have to. The whole experience. What happened with me was that it was a 9-month program, I think. And after 3 months, 3.5 months, I dropped out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And some others did. Because I was really more interested in what Fritz was doing than the encounter group thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Celia's dad was there, and there's the beautiful, and it's Big Sur, of course, you know.
Right.
And so I started working for him.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so, you know, that's, then I had to make a choice of whether I was going to go on with my education or whether I was going to stay in Big Sur.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, and then there's the draft too was an issue. I mean, Fritz asked me to go to this place in Canada where he was going to, but I think he wasn't doing me a favor. He wanted me to do him a favor,
mm-hmm.
and go up there and do maintenance and grounds, whatever, but I didn't do that, and I just ended up, the draft thing just ended up petering out eventually. They, you know, I didn't look like some of these other radicals because it was more conscience totally, and yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. So you.
But anyway, the whole experience, yeah.
Yeah, you met Selig Morgenrath then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, first before you met Celia.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was working for him, and he was taking me to town and stopped by at Rocky Creek, and that was the first time I saw her. And then,
okay.
Yeah.
So they lived in with Rocky Creek with Helen there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Selig lived at Esalen. Or nearby.
He did live at Esalen, actually, yeah. But he had Partington, and he was working on the house.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And I'd go up and help. We'd go and help him. I'd help him some sometimes.
Right.
Go up there, yeah, and do that. He's doing all the rock work.
Uh-huh. Who else helped up there?
Oh, boy, I can't. I know Helmuth did, and I'm not sure about anybody else that I can remember. So he would remember better than I would on that.
Helmuth is born... Are you older or younger? You're a little older than Helmuth, right?
Right. He's born in, I'm 6 years older.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
But you were almost, I mean, when you are 20, I mean, at age 26 and onwards, you're both fully grown and adult, so to speak.
He and I were really close. I went through his teenage time in his high school and dropping out and working with Helen, and he was down there with his working with his dad. I'll never forget, his dad sent me down to work on a sewer line, and I was loving the sewer line work, you know. I was like down there, and he came down there to help me, you know. And so I told him, I said, gosh, you know, I was really enjoying this, you know. And it's nothing personal, but I was kind of, have to adjust it, you're being here. It blew him away.
Yeah.
He just, ever since then, he just loved the fact, I don't know if I'd say those things today, but then, you know, that's how we were.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
What we were learning.
Right.
Be real, right?
Right.
Be honest.
Yeah.
It just really impressed us. And we had a great relationship. Yeah. And his father, I mean, his father was a great teacher. He considered himself a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But his view on art and all that and life was, even though he had, it's a funny thing how that is with people feel... You'll say something about Fritz, and they'll say, oh, well, the guy was a egotist, or he was some other prima donna, right? That kind of thing.
Right, diva.
I always thought, that's not a reason to throw out what they're telling you.
Right, right.
That's what they do. They reject the whole, if he's not all that way, then...
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They don't, they kind of shut down.
Right.
Which is too bad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'll tell you another story from Esalen. This is the kind of thing. I mean, it's such an incredible place. But I was that little path that goes down to the baths. Mm-hmm. The septic tank, the grease trap for the kitchen was there, and so I was down there in that shoveling out this kind of smelly. It's not poop smelly, but it's grease smelly, right? I'm shoveling this stuff out. You know, the ocean's there. You know, the way I can hear it. The baths right below. I mean, down further. And I'm sweating. I'm shoveling, and I'm loving every minute of it, right? And Alan Watts is walking up the hill. Right? Yeah. Walking up the hill to give a seminar.
Right.
And he looks down at me and he says, you know, I envy you. Because in the monasteries, the monks clean the latrines and the students dust the books. And I knew exactly what he meant, because that's exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's the...
There's something about the physicality of doing it. I mean,
yeah,
can you explain?
Right. Instead of the more abstract.
Right. Something real, like carry water.
So, this is pretty funny, because I like a lot of intellectual things, but Celia's dad would make a joke about intellectuals can't shit.
Wow.
Well, that's the kind of thing. You could see that's what I'm talking about how valuable it is.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure.
So you're on your way into town, and you stop by Rocket Creek, and you meet this young girl.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
Well, I mean, we saw each other again. I don't know how that all developed over time. I mean, well, it did, though. I mean, mm-hmm. she was, you know, I met Helmuth, and so we ended up doing stuff up here. Mm-hmm. So we just, you know, through those meetings, we got close, and mm-hmm. yeah. So
pretty soon, you decided to become a couple.
Well, that was interesting. Well, she was young, and she's 15, and I was. I people say you robbed the cradle. I think, you know, I wasn't an old fart. You know, I was pretty damn young. When I look back, I didn't have enough knowledge to know that I was robbing any cradle.
Right,
what are you talking about? I just was in love. You know, we were having, you know, we loved each other. What are you talking about?
So she was 15 when you first met?
15, yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. Must have been. She's born in 1953, so.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you had a relationship for quite some
got a relationship, and then she was going to move down and be with her dad mm-hmm. in Partington, built a loft, and I was building a loft for her, and we decided to be together. I was living in the back of the shop at Esalen in a one-room mm-hmm. thing, and we decided we lived together back there, so she never moved up to her dad. We stayed together as a couple in that back of the shop.
Right, at Esalen.
With Jafu. Yeah. He used to stay. We stole his quarters. Jafu was the you know, what do you call that? It's Tai Chi, yeah. Uh-huh. Tai Chi guy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you go out on the deck and you watch the, you know. It's pretty much fun, you know?
Yeah. Did Celia get a job at Esalen too?
Yeah, she did waitressing, yeah.
Okay. That's a large thing, basically.
Yeah. She did some of that. So Jeannie Reppy, you know, uh-huh. when I first was there, Jeannie Reppy was a waitress.
Yeah. But they had waitresses then, because they don't.
I know.
They actually served.
It was so festive.
Like Alan Watts sat there and got
and
served.
So it was so festive. And the conversation, you sit at a table with John Blybetroy, who wrote The Parable of the Beast, and who was, you know, he was there, and Fritz, and, you know, the other people that came through. You sit down, the conversations, you know, and they're in their kind of 60s dresses, you know, and waiting, and I mean, the thing was, I can idealize that pretty easily. I can embellish it all you want.
Right. What about the one issue that everybody also associated with, which is all the drugs and the psychedelic drugs and all of that. How much did that in time there?
it was an invaluable experience. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a pothead or like some people,
right.
You know, is all they would get into. I mean, I do remember that it was, yeah, it was significant. I mean, I only took LSD once, but I cannot tell you a better environment to have done it in.
Right.
Yeah. Wherever I went,
right,
there was support.
Yeah.
They just keep you going and keep you getting into it. And I wanted right. to look at what the death trip meant to me, you know, anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you can't beat that. But right. there was, I can remember, and I'll tell you a couple stories about that. One is that when we first did with the residential program, we got in pickups, and we're going to take a hike up Arroyo Seco to Tassajara, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of the folks, I didn't, but they were smoking pot and, you know, all this stuff. So we start hiking up the creek, mm-hmm. right? Well, first we get there late, you know, and then there's stone, half stone, and then they're hiking up the creek. Well, it gets dark, you know. And so Paul Herbert and I, St. Paul Herbert, that took all these pictures of Helen,
yeah,
and, you know, was with
yeah,
the family,
yeah.
he and I stayed at the end of it to make sure there's no one behind us, because the leaders, forget it.
Right, right.
You know, one was Will Schutz, who did that. He was the leader of our encounter of the residential program. He and I didn't get along. I mean, we're okay, but we just didn't. He wrote the group called Joy, mm-hmm. you know, and he developed these techniques in encounter groups, like
right.
you, like if you say you don't trust somebody, then you stand in the room and they fall back and you catch them.
Right.
And that for me was sort of ABC. It wasn't what Fritz was about.
Right.
You know,
right.
Fritz used to tease him about being the Turner Honors.
Uh-huh.
It was a big deal because it brought a lot of money to Esalen.
Right.
Those groups.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was on this hike. But anyhow, so, yeah. So we got strung out uh-huh. up that creek, and the monks had to come down and fetch us. It's a whole bloody group.
The Tassajara monks.
Yeah, so yeah. That I don't think that use of
right.
pot was
right,
a very good
right,
one.
Right, right.
And then we had a seminar, and this was some of his things, and this is a scary thing. This is something that I remind people of, or I'm reminded of. I was reminded of actually when the Panetta Bill came up in the 70s here. There were two psychologists in it, let's see, three, Art Walshaw, and another two PhD psychologists in the group, a priest, anyway. And some of the folks that had came to our session had smoked pot. And this guy, Art Warshaw, PhD in psychology, made a comment about how he felt weak and he maybe wanted to die, and so he felt weak. So one of the little techniques that Will Schutz would do is you make a circle and put him in the middle, and you say you break out of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you gain your strength, feeling of strength, that you can break out of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it changes the context.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I had a hard time with those things. Fall down so you can trust somebody when I think something else is going on psychologically. I'm
right.
You can just do that.
Right.
And that was my feeling at the time. I was pretty critical of it. But anyhow, maybe that's one reason I didn't stay in. Probably is the reason. Anyhow, it went from an exercise to being real. Where everybody in that circle, we are not going to let him out, period.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this experience of one mind, where you lose your control of your own ability to discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
It was very scary.
Yeah.
I mean, to see how that could happen,
mm-hmm.
you know, and yeah. So I think of that once when people get hysteric and fearful and you know how dangerous that is.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up in a fight with one of them and got pushed through a window.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
But you know, these are such
tomorrow. So you want to say what experiences they are? I'm telling you, where do you find those experiences?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But these are tumultuous years at Esalen. You're there during the time where there are many, 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 many books are written about those years.
Yes.
And you are
right.
in one way, you are at the center of, not the whole thing, but a significant part of that hippie era has tentacles that goes to Esalen.
Yeah, you know what I thought about being in that group? There were two of us, so there was another guy, I don't know what happened to him, or he was 20 or something, but afterwards, thought it was really great for me to be kind of young, because I didn't end up the focus.
Right.
You know, yeah. And it's like a little kid, you know, you think they're falling around, you don't know they're listening, and they're picking it all up.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of like it was for me.
Right.
I was in that, where I didn't have a career that I'd already established I had to deal with, or, yeah. You know, so I could really see all these things. Uh-huh. I thought it was a real advantage.
What did your father think of all this?
Well, you know, my father.
Did he come visit?
No, but my mother was worried. I mean, she's worried just because she's worried about what am I going to do with my life? What's my career going to be, as her mother would,
sure,
right?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, she was, yeah. but you know, she clearly was worried about it. No, my father was, you know, he was a well-thought philosophy person, and he saw the value in all these experiences,
mm-hmm.
and
probably would have
liked it. Was concerned. Well, they were also with the draft. They were worried that if I went to jail, that I wouldn't be able to get a government job.
Right.
I was under 20 years old. Who needs a government job?
Yeah. But
I don't. It was. I think it was tough for her, but you know, I've always felt that's one great thing about my parents, and for her, and her really is that they really believed in their kids being their own person. Just give them the tools. It's what you got to try and give them the right environment to have it. They grew out of the depression. She grew out of a family, broken family. So they were really committed.
Right.
To that. There's no agenda neither my sister and I ever felt that they laid a trip on us
right.
for an agenda that we
right.
had to do
right.
to make up for whatever they're like. That's, you know, and that, you know, that, to me, that's the most key thing in raising kids, and how many people miss that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, how do you think, as, I mean, this is nothing, you wouldn't know this probably at all, but talk about it anyway, about how Esalen must have been, it is today too, but back then, where you had the philosophy of, you know, sharing and peace, and the whole hippie idea, right, was so naive in many ways, like we live here and we commune with nature, and Esalen symbolized that back then, right? How did they keep it from just becoming overwhelmed with people? How did the gate work in those days? How did
you mean robot?
Maybe robot. I mean,
he was head of security.
Yeah. But you know what I'm thinking about here? I mean, it seems to me that it's so.
It was so structured, though.
And Big Sur was such a magnet. Big Sur itself.
Yeah, but it's still structured. You couldn't just
walk in.
I mean,
right.
I mean, you could walk in and be, you know, catch up with some people, but it sort of had a limit to
right.
how you could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, and they had people that are giving seminars. I mean, and Alan Watts is there. And,
right.
And you know,
but
and those who else?
But people people knew that the discipline at the gate was such that you couldn't just walk in.
They must have, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't open. It wasn't wide open.
Right, and it worked. Obviously, there was not a big conflict every day between the guards and people from the outside. As far as
I don't. That's a good question. I don't know exactly where that line was drawn. I know there was this guy, this drummer Jeffrey, whatever the heck he was. And I'll tell you another thing that really was. Yeah, there was a tolerance. There was not a tolerance for getting overwhelmed, for sure. And
mm-hmm.
so his dad wouldn't allow it, for sure.
Right.
You know, and I can remember that they had. You know, I was there for two or three of the folk festivals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for him, it was terrible. Because
for who?
So his dad,
uh-huh.
because they'd stand on the fire pits. And,
right.
You know, all,
right.
all of that stuff that would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know Murphy? Did you know Murphy and Price, Dick Price, too?
Michael, I knew very little of. You know, he was in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Already.
He was sort of, but Dick was around.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Dick better, but not great. Dick was a guy. He would build rock walls.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of that dichotomy in a way. His figures that Michael would be in San Francisco. He was more the head tripper
mm-hmm.
guy, and Dick was the more, you know, hands in the soil
right.
person.
Yeah,
which I was attracted to.
Relate to. Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we go I love going up the canyon. In fact, there's a period of time when I had a little campsite up the canyon, Hot Springs Canyon, I would go up there and, and sleep up there just to be, because I like, I mean, I was, when I was in high school, I would, and college actually, when I was home, I'd go drive up to the Sierras on the weekends and hike by myself. Right. So obviously that fits here.
Right.
Charlie Rose had a guy on, I forgot what his name, it's a really great guy, and I forgot what his, anyway. So he was talking about New York and how great it is in New York, and the guy said, yeah, man, you know, New York is great, you know. You know, otherwise it'd be like camping. I'm so thrilled off it. Man, when we got this property, I thought, man, I can camp for life. I can camp out for life. Well, how do you beat that, man? Wow, yeah. I'll have to drive from L.A. and hike up that mountain to walk out and see the stars
camping.
Every night.
Yeah.
Permanent camping, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So when you said, earlier you said, it was Big Sur, you said. Were you conscious of Big Sur being a special space and place already then? Do you think in 66, 67? Did you think of Big Sur as a place apart?
I found it to be. I don't think I, you know, thought of it that way. I worked for the auto club during the summers. Wrote maps, sent people all over the place. San Simeon's where we sent them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There wasn't any. You got to drive the Big Sur coast.
Right.
That was not, honestly, that was not something you tell people to do.
Right.
You tell them 43 miles north of San Luis Obispo, wherever it is, is Hearst Castle.
Yeah.
Go see that.
Yeah.
Period. Or they'd ask. Isn't that funny? And now, yeah, we had no.
Right.
None of that. Huh. I never thought of that, but that's right. Huh. Yeah, it was.
So then the history continues. You live there together with Celia at Esalen. Then what is the next?
Well, then that, well, they got the property here,
mm-hmm.
and then I was helping Helen about, and then Clovis and Helen, they bought 15 acres to sell 5 of it to help pay for their 2 5-acre lots,
mm-hmm.
and so then I got wind of that, and so. I asked, you think maybe we could buy it, and they would love that. They liked that idea, and so I got, it was $15,000. I got $5,000 from my parents, and I was working at Esalen for $3 an hour, and I needed $350 to pay the $110 payment, right?
Right.
And they wouldn't give it to me. So Helmuth and I both quit Esalen, and I ended up working on this distribute house up here, for Don McQueen.
Okay.
And we bought it, and then I put it in both our names. We weren't married, so it was Celius Morganrath and Ray Samborn. That was the ownership.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were an unmarried young couple living here, and you built yourself a little home?
Well, we had a trailer,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, we were married in 71. So after a couple of years, we just thought, why don't we get married? Because we de facto are married.
Right.
And we had a marriage, had a wedding, I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, down the road here.
The Grange?
71. No, it was at, I was saying Mary Cross, not Mary Cross, it was Jackman property.
Uh-huh.
It was a friend that we met that was renting it. Yeah.
Okay.
Where Dick lives.
Uh-huh.
We were married in this orchard field below his house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that was
71.
Okay. Uh-huh. And then what happens? You're up here?
Yeah. And then I worked for McQueen, and then we built the house. And, I worked on weekends and got, Gary McQueen would dig a ditch. I mean, I had construction jobs. So
yeah.
I was learning construction and working on the house.
Right.
Yeah. And then, Salig asked me to build Julian Silverman's house down at Esalen.
Uh-huh.
He was a manager at the time.
Right.
Julian Silverman. Or he was a manager. Yeah. Yeah, he was a great guy. He taught the course on miracles. I'm not familiar with it, but he used to teach that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then he moved up to Squim. He was married to to and had three kids when we built the house, and they divorced, and he married the sister who Brian Lyke is married to.
Okay.
Yeah. Went off to Squim, Washington, but he died. He had some unfortunate thing. Medical. Yeah, he's a great guy.
But so that's what happens in a way. You are at Essendon, and then you end up in the construction trade all your life, right? Pretty much, right? Isn't that so?
Yeah.
that's cool.
It's a little ways from reading Heidegger, isn't it?
Yeah, no, nice. But you become part of the Blaze Engineering.
No.
But that's after. I mean, sort of like that.
Well, I ended up working for I built Jillian's house, and then this farm thing came up.
Right.
George, we got friends with George. And,
yeah.
And yeah, so we went back to Missouri, right?
Uh-huh.
We tried our hand at it.
Uh-huh.
It's a great life.
How did it?
It's totally a great life.
Yeah.
You can't be denied.
Were you gone for two
years.
Full years?
Yeah, actually more than that, because we had a cousin in Montana. We went there first to see, because he had ranches there. We still had bit by the farming bug, and then
yeah.
We went back to Missouri for a summer, and then we went back to where Arden and Jeannie were, and then we came back here.
Okay. Wow. So that when you gave it the full-on attempt at living a life of being a gardener, being kind of back to nature, was that part of the philosophy? You went to an actual commercial farm, or how?
No, small. There's small farms in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
and this one was, I think it was 500 acres, and or 300 acres, can't remember. Anyway, we had the full on. We plowed. I had corn. We had corn, soybeans, grew hay. Had cows, cow calf. Had hogs, raised baby hogs, the whole thing.
Wow. And you, you and who?
Celia.
And?
And Basil was there, but no.
When did, what year is Basil born?
He was born in 73.
Okay. So
just before we moved there, we moved there in 74.
Exactly, he must have been like an infant when you were
there. Yeah, he was a little, 73, but there's 74, he was,
1, 2 years.
Started walking, yeah.
Okay. And then so what happens? Why do you think why didn't it work?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. I think one was that it was economically didn't make sense.
Right.
We didn't want to have, be farming. I mean, my uncle's really great, but we didn't want to be farming his farm all the time.
Right.
And then we didn't want to, always felt that I was going to come back here.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't want to sell this to buy the farm or buy part of the farm.
Right.
You just couldn't do that. And so it was also having struggles with being so far away from the family.
Mm-hmm.
I think those things is what that just, yeah, didn't. My sister stayed there. But
so
yeah, it's a tough life.
Yeah.
You know, most of the farms, those small farms in Missouri, in fact, probably practically all of them, very few are really full-time farmers.
Uh-huh.
They usually have sharecropped and
right.
Or they just do hogs, or but yeah, no, we had it all. Yeah,
wow.
And
you got up at
it's
early
just a great
in the morning.
Life.
Early in the morning, working all day.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah. No, yeah.
Yeah.
it's tough. I mean, you work hard all day, and you got paperwork at night.
Yeah.
It's full on.
Yeah.
But it's very. There's some real purity about it because you're both really focused. Everybody knows, each of you know what you're doing. There's none of this, how come you're not doing this today or something there,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
How come you're not taking care of me now, you know?
Right.
It's all very straight.
Yeah.
So that way it's full life. Yeah.
And Sundays?
No, it's Sunday to me. We might take afternoon. No, we still have chores on Sunday. So
right.
It depends what was happening.
Yeah.
Of course. If you're mowing hay, you're not going to take off Sunday.
No. And then the wintertime, you had heavy snow.
So I get there, and I go with these farms, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is when I first get there. And these farmers have these gates, and they drag it across the ground, and then they have a piece of baling wire to close them. I think, why don't they fix their gates?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a novice builder type,
Yeah.
And I think, God, you can fix your gates, right?
Uh-huh.
a year later, you know what my gates were like? No. Dragging on the ground with baited wire.
Because
I was digging fence holes. You know, when you dig fence post holes, it's in the summer, right?
Right.
No, try digging them in the winter when you got this much permafrost. You have to take a bar.
Yeah.
Because that's when I could do it.
Sure, sure.
There's a reality there.
Yeah, yeah. But then in the wintertime, also, there's a reality of sitting at home in the dark. No, it's not so dark there, but it's cold, and then you have to keep the house warm and keep the animals warm, and it's a whole different set of
Missouri, yeah.
Yeah.
And hot and humid in the summer. I like the hot and humidity, but cold and wearing, you have to have a boiler, yeah.
Yeah, you did two winters up here. Right. Because I always think of the Swedish farmers, you know, that thought they came to heaven, you know, in one way, but they also didn't realize that it was actually colder. In large part of Missouri is colder than any place in Sweden.
Yeah, and you know, it's great days, and the winters are too long.
Right.
And then you have, for me anyway,
yeah.
I mean, Southern California boy, you know, but there's this long period where it's just gray and it's just mucky.
Yeah.
You know, between. If it was shorter, it'd make a lot. Like, I always loved it when it got to be 20 and the ground was frozen, so I wasn't walking around in the mud.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it's different.
Yeah.
But then it's so lush and full in the summertime.
Right, right.
You know, everything grows everywhere, and there's fireflies. And
yeah.
And there's some beautiful times. I mean, I love being out in the middle of the pasture plowing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a thunderstorm would come through.
Right.
Yeah, the smells.
So there was not. Yeah. So when you came back here, you weren't entirely free of that. You sometimes thought nostalgically about going back there.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So here you are, though. Here you are on the hill here with the whole family here, or Helen with. I mean, let's see back then. Then, so what was the layout?
When we were in Missouri, Helen. Jolly bought their properties.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And I don't know when Tara did, but it was soon, because I designed their house.
Yeah.
And so that had to be early 80s, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, when they bought that property.
Right, right.
Next to Martha there.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a time, which is really amazing, people I made comments with, when you had a mother with four kids, and all five had their own properties on the same hill.
I know.
It's unheard of.
It's totally unheard of.
Yeah.
It always has blown me away, always, the thing about the Morgenrath Hill here.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody still staying home.
It just worked out that way.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Well, one thing that, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So when Basil grew up, and what year is Brandon born?
79.
So they are
6.5 years apart.
Right, right. So the kids are here, and there are other kids up here at the time. I can't think of them now, but
the whole group of them.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. So they. So in that way, I'm asking you the question I'm going to ask you already, I suppose, which was, for some people in Big Sur, the isolation was a challenge.
Not for them.
But not for you, and
not for them
so much. No.
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 And they still get together.
Yeah.
The troops, you know, Bram's guys.
Right. Right. So for you and Celia, that was never a kind of a worry or a concern.
When we're all down in the cabin drinking alcohol was.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right, right. But that's the same no matter where you live. But as far as that part of the Big Sur life, that wasn't a concern for you so much.
You mean as
that the kids were too isolated?
No,
no. Where did they go to school?
They went to Captain Cooper,
mm-hmm.
then to middle school, and then Basil, when he was in 10th grade or 11th grade, I guess, we had taken over Ripple. We had taken on Ripplewood,
mm-hmm.
and Sky and Basil, we talked. We and Helmuth, and I don't know exactly what prompted it, but we ended up applying to put them in at RLS.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I mean, it was one of the reasons was we, first of all, we're entering a life that is kind of full time where we're not going to have as much time to do all the extracurricular support for our kid,
right?
Kids, right? And he was in a class of, Bass was in a class of like 40 kids, and I just felt like me, I felt like he could fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. And so, and we had the income to be able to make that work, so that's what happened. He went to RLS, mm-hmm. and then to Davis. I mean, then the MPC in Davis, and then Branham, when he got to the after middle school, we sent him to RLS.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. So they both graduated from our RLS.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And now, this coming year, all four of our grandchildren are going to be there.
Nice.
Yeah, it's an incredible school. I mean, you go there and you see what they do and their philosophy, and you think, God, this should be available to everybody.
Right.
But it's in a way, it's too expensive for what it is. I mean,
what's the ratio of teacher student?
Oh yeah, well that was the biggest thing. That's right. The biggest reason too was it was like 10-1 or something.
Yeah.
Or yeah, it probably is because their classes, they have 20 kids and they have two teachers in the classroom.
Right. Right.
Yeah, it's a real. I mean, for Basil, they obviously can handle that, but for Branham, it's a real bite. They both work their butts.
Right.
It's a huge commitment.
Yeah.
So.
Talk a little bit about how
Carmel schools are a lot better now.
Uh-huh, than they were 20 years ago.
Branham and Eric are in Monterey, and Branham told me that if they lived in the Carmel district, they would send their kids to Carmel school. They wouldn't go to RLS.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's how much better.
And he's a school psychologist.
Right. 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 Wow. So talk a little bit about how what happened when you guys took over. How did that happen? The Ripplewood thing.
I was building Ken's house,
mm-hmm.
and Ted Hartman, who doesn't have to work. Frank used to always say, my best carpenter is one that doesn't have to work, because Ted Hartman would work, and he doesn't need a job, really, right? And Elise, and Ted and Robbie and I basically built that house, and the lease, daughter's lease came up, and we asked Ted, and Ted asked Marty, and
so okay.
That's how we ended up there.
Right, a lease from Ted and Marty, obviously.
Yeah.
Is how it worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not more complex than that.
No.
No. Ted Hartman was he a very particularly good carpenter?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
he was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Frank, he was working with Frank when I was working for Bixer Construction.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Down. Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about Frank Trotter.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Working for Frank Trotter. Did Frank Trotter have a contractor's license?
You know, I don't know who had the license. It was Bixer Construction, so it was, and Don started, and it was Don and Frank and Everett. Mm-hmm. And,
Walter? No.
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 I don't think so in the beginning. Maybe something happened in the beginning, but I don't think so. It wasn't certainly when I started working for him in 78. Was it a little sooner, 77, 78, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on John Harlan's house with Frank. And, yeah, I don't know who had the license
mm-hmm.
back then.
Right.
Maybe it was Eric. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either.
I don't know what it took to have a license in those days either. I don't see Frank wanting to go take a test and all that crap. I mean,
No.
It seemed like it's something he went, well, stupid, I won't take that. You know?
Exactly. That's a reader.
Yeah.
So you worked with Everett also for many, many years?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Everett was working on Flory's, which is now... what's her name? Cleefields up on top.
Uh-huh, Carolyn. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he did that.
Yeah.
We were working on Esther Booz, and then I worked on Harlan's house with Frank for a good while, and then I did Ken's house. So
mm-hmm.
I didn't really work with Everett on a job. Everett did Richardson's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't. I work on that. I did some wiring down there, but that's, yeah.
They've made such a mark, Frank and Walter and Sam, on the coast. It's kind of mind-boggling, because every time you speak with someone, their names come up, always.
Well, that's good to hear, because I don't... Yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah. Just impacting...
Frank was great.
Yeah. Impacting so much for so many people. I mean, not just the fact that they had a hand in constructing almost everything on the coast.
You know, we drove down to the sea every day, and he'd have me drive, you know. He'd sit there, this old gray 50s pickup, you know, sing.
Yeah,
he's great. All those guys, Franklin Peace. And yeah, they're all characters.
Pat Chamberlain?
It didn't have too much to do with him, actually.
What about Don McQueen?
Well, McQueen was you know, that's who I hooked up with to work at Estabus, and who I worked with a lot. And he, when I got the job to build Silverman's house, and I never built anything before that, you know, so he got upset. You know, ended up on his enemies list.
Oh no!
He's the kind of guy that, you know, you're either in his family or you're not.
No, okay.
You know, when you're not in his family, then you know.
Not gonna happen.
And that same thing happened to Helmuth. But yeah, it's amazing. He's doing well. You know, the great thing about Don, I talked to the fellow that's working for him, you know, up there, is that he loves doing projects, and he has that. And I have that same interest. I know he loves creating things and making things. And he has money to buy the tools.
Right.
Keeps having it. That's what keeps him going.
Yeah.
He's just totally into it.
Right.
And you just see it. I think it's just great that he's doing that. I really do. I think it's just great that he just. Yeah, that's so much fun.
Mm-hmm. If you think about the happenstance that this really all our lives are, and I mean they are, right? I mean these little things that happen.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, right. You could have just
these
as well.
People that say I earned it, you know, what a bunch of bullshit. You know, they don't. And you have so many people that you do hear that talk about how much luck played into where they end up.
Yeah.
Huge factor,
right? And then of course, you make your own luck too, of course, by holding on to the things that you recognize are valuable. So if you say then that you, in some ways, you did that, you held on to the things that you felt were valuable, the friendships you had with Celik, the relationship you had with Celia, the extraordinary privilege of being at this place called Esalen. Right? Those are three things that stand up in my mind right now.
Oh yeah.
And in that context, we also have Big Sur, the place.
Well, and Fritz and Tillich, you know, I mean, these people were, you know, I mean, I was...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So was it inevitable for you?
Huh. I don't see how. I don't think so. I mean, I could have been still in school or some social services position somewhere just as easily.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. If I didn't take that, if I didn't by accident take this elective class, because I didn't take any educational psych class, and I didn't end up coming up here.
Yeah.
What would I have done with the whole 60 things? Where would I have ended up? I would have been, you know, obviously probably on the. Well, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could have gone to Vietnam for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I just think life is, you know, it's a very fine line between one thing and another.
Yeah. If you meet somebody, I don't know how often, you've traveled a little bit and you meet somebody in a faraway place, let's say you went to Washington, D.C. or something for a tourist trip, you and Celia. Then you sit in a restaurant with some strangers, and so where do you live? And you say, I live in Big Sur. I've been living there for a long time. And they say, Big Sur, what's that? What do you say to people?
Well, fortunately, I don't think I get asked that question very often. Most of the people know, they mostly say, oh yeah, lucky you. It's
right,
exactly what I get now.
Right, but you didn't back in. If you rewind the clock to 1985, you wouldn't. I mean, a few people would know, but not at all the same way as it is now. How would you describe it to a stranger?
Other than the beautiful land and the country, probably I wouldn't say too much more. I wouldn't say anything about the culture.
Right. Yeah. But you would say something. Say, okay. So the next question from them across the table is: so why do you live there then, if it's just beautiful?
I go, huh?
But the answer to that question But the answer to that question is maybe interesting though. So why do you live here?
Well, I love it here, and of course, once I have this property, I have this spot, this treasure.
Yeah.
Where I can walk out and see the stars. I mean, it's like I can't. Yeah. Yeah, I'm very fortunate. It is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. How fortunate we are.
Right.
When you think about what goes on out there.
Yeah.
It really. It's like, oy, this is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of that.
How fortunate it is for you that you ended up here. You feel that way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what a, I mean, I walk outside and I don't hear anything oftentimes, or see a light.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, there's a guy that, like, New York is the best place ever. And
sure, yeah. And they've experienced darkness once in their lives.
Yeah, and then there's friends like Annika Newell and some other people that grew up here, that still have one foot in Big Sur and one foot in the other world.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones, I think, that have kind of the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
She mentions that. They want to be here, and yet they have the life, and there's a lot to appreciate where they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they still have this link to here,
right.
This experience, and it's so unique.
Yeah. You're talking about people who recently acquired.
Born and raised here.
Born and raised here, okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Not someone who came here and discovered it. You know, it's
right.
That. There's a different perspective, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a different perspective for Celia, who was born and raised here. The way that she looks at it compared to me, I think it's a little bit different, because it's always been this way. Whereas for me, it's like, I didn't.
Right.
I know. I mean, I had that other world that came out of the world.
In knowing some of Celia's early history, they really went through the ringer in a way. I mean, struggling, and yet stayed here this whole time.
Quite you heard her speech, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was really great.
Fantastic. Yeah, it was such a beautiful ceremony for Helen.
Yeah.
And the fact that they all spoke and so genuinely and from the heart, it was.
And there was a lot of tough things for her. Sandy Justice and
these
people that came Helen's way were not, some were alcoholics and
abusive.
All this other, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Huh.
Yeah.
So if we think about Big Sur then as a place to live and for you to work and be involved in the community, because you yourself have been involved with the health center and the fire brigade and I think the library maybe and
my ambulance.
Yeah, and so you've done a lot of community service over the years.
That's me.
Yeah, I know.
this thing about retirement. Can you imagine going somewhere and just being sitting on a golf course and just doing, just doing stuff for yourself.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Right.
I'm not happy with that. In fact, when we left Ripplewood, when that ended, I didn't think I'd have this problem, but the challenge I ended up having was the challenge about purpose. It was real obvious what purpose I had.
Right.
At Ripplewood. It's all when you're raising kids. It's all very, you kind of take it for granted.
Right. Right.
But then when all of a sudden the only purpose is to just sustain yourself or your wife and yourself or something, it's.
Right.
I had to struggle with that.
Yeah.
I did. I came to a place where I was handling it, and then I got blown off the mountain.
Right. Basics. But you have to buy a couple of dogs. Wow. So yeah, but that the reason I started that way was also to maybe because you've been so engaged, therefore you've also been very aware of what is going on in this strange community. Because what I mentioned, when I mentioned the schools, the health center, the fire brigade, then we are pretty much kind of covering the community organizations in Big Sur. Those are really the ones that that actually gather people together,
mm-hmm.
with a common purpose. Mm-hmm. The Grange a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Then we have the places like the Henry Miller Library or the Public Library, or of course the some of the community events that happens at Nepenthe and those things. But fundamentally, it's the fire brigade, the health center, and the schools that really bring the community together. You've been involved in all of those. How has things since you got here and since you started getting involved in the community, if you were to talk a little bit about how it has changed over the years?
I worry about it.
Uh-huh.
I get, when we have some events and things that happen, you know, I feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's still community, but it's not as extensive as it was.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And what?
I don't know.
I'm not as in.
I'm kind of out of the loop.
Uh-huh.
You know.
When you say you worry, when you have a concern or a worry about the community changing or not being as healthy or something, what would it be? Do you think?
It's all about community, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I made the comment that, you know, community is food for the soul.
Right.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
And so it's very important.
Yeah.
It is changing, it is being challenged. Our ridge more so than you. I always think your ridge, more than Partington. Mm-hmm. Where you still have a lot, still people have been there forever, living there, and family like you. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
here it's less and less and less.
Yeah.
You know, and Coastlands is Coastlands. When I came, Coastlands, look what Coastlands was.
Right.
With Skiles and Kayo and Chenery
yeah.
and all those people that were there.
Yeah.
All gone.
Right.
All gone.
Yeah.
So that's, you know. That's
Betty. Still hanging in there.
Yeah, Betty.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's hard to watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I feel we can't even get, it's hard to get enough people on a board in these organizations. To serve on a board for the water company, road company, or.
Right. Right.
You know, so.
No,
the human resource thing is really a challenge. And the river run, you know, we started that. That's been 37, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a ton of volunteers compared to what we get now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fortunately, we've been able to get electronic scoring, so that eliminated, now we can make up for the loss.
Mm-hmm.
But that pool's not here anymore.
Right.
You know, it really isn't. I'm happy. Fire Brigade does, they're getting people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good, and I always thought that was going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. They've done a great job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they really have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think
so. There's pluses, you know. There's
mm-hmm.
things that happen.
Well, there are some good things amongst the general kind of decline.
And really, I had our water. We're I was thinking about this the other day. The people that are in our one water company,
mm-hmm.
they're all really good people. They're all really supportive. They don't have any issues. We're not spending a lot of money on lawsuits like other organizations I know about. I'm a member of, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like I'm not. Yeah, you guys. So,
well, that's good.
So,
yeah.
So yeah, and I have. There's two people that are willing to serve on our board that live here part time,
mm-hmm.
and they're willing to do emails and whatever else. And that's. This just happened this last week. I thought that was, they really want to
participate,
and they're and so that's even with the loss of permanency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a
I think I'll tell you this one. When the health center started, I thought of this the other day because you were coming. I thought, well, you know, when they asked me to help with the health center, mm-hmm. you know, back in this is what it was like in 1978. Mm-hmm. You know, I always felt the reason was because I had my foot in two communities, uh-huh. the counterculture community and the Frank Trotter community.
Right.
So I could talk both languages.
Which is true.
Yeah.
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 Well, that's no longer obviously the case. But I just thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, and the health centers, I mean, it's incredible how it's a vital part of this community.
It is.
What the service it provided Helen.
Yeah.
You know, what it can do.
Yeah.
It's just such a tough nut. It takes so much money.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
Health center and the health center and the fire brigade, gets some nice donations from some of the community members, and also when you have a fire like we did in 2008 and in 2013, forget not 12,
yeah.
13,
yeah,
yeah. you would remember probably the year that happened, that last fire.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. We could laugh about it now, but it's a very recent one, and I'm just saying that those cataclysmic events on the coast, they obviously make a very strong argument for the importance of having a local fire brigade.
Oh yeah.
Because they can frequently prevent something like that from happening, and also of course when it is happening, be extremely helpful. The fire that happened in 2013, which was devastating and extraordinarily quick to damage a bunch of property.
Right.
Tell me about that. What happened?
You mean from what happened to us?
Yeah.
Well, it was the middle of the night. So you smelled smoke. We're in the back room of this house, where we were sleeping, and she went out and saw the orange glow and came in and got me, and I went outside, and it was raining embers from the sky. I could not believe what I had seen. I called Ken, and I called 911, and then I...
Phone was working?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then we had to get out of here. How many times? This is right here.
How far away were the flames?
Well, she went down the driveway and saw them coming up. It was a wind driven. It was coming this direction,
right.
And she ran down the driveway and came back and hollered at me that we gotta go, and that I, you know, she wouldn't leave without me. She's worried I'd stay.
Right.
And so I grabbed one of Jean Perrine's paintings and just dropped it. I don't know.
Yeah. You realized.
I was also panicked.
Yeah.
And actually, our place was the first one to burn down, according to Angus. It burned down before Martha. It's not that it matters, but it's just like, that's how quick it was.
Right.
Yeah. So she went up the hill and warned the family, you know, and I went up to, yeah, I went up above and looked at the glow.
Wow. Right.
Yeah.
At that time, when was the first, when did you first realize that you actually had lost your home?
Oh, I knew it when I left. It wasn't going to survive.
Okay. That's
okay.
That's how
oh, yeah,
indulged.
There was no chance.
Yeah.
No.
There were so many.
If I had sprinklers that I could have got, Tevye came down here and we'd already left, I might have had time to get the sprinklers going on the main building. I probably would. Because I'll never forget the Rat Creek fire. Adelman had sprinklers around his house, and that fire came through there. They weren't there, and his house was still standing.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to all the trouble plumbing all this in,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't tested them in a while, I didn't have the time to do it. And you know, this is December. What was it? 16th?
Mm-hmm.
We're not thinking fire.
Right.
You know, we're thinking rain.
Right.
So we're not, you know, this is what how the pattern we go through. We think, you know, when summer comes, we think fire, and then when winter starts approaches, we think rain. So we're doing our roofs and buttoning down and covering up and doing all that stuff for the rain, and then in the summertime we're doing, well, this was
upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, so man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't see how it was. Jolly was at the corner of the road here with the water truck, and he was turning around, and I just, you can't, from my perspective, I couldn't tell how quick it was going to get here.
Right.
So he thinks it was 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I don't know, I haven't talked to him.
Right.
But it wasn't much time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Yeah.
But it was, for me, like I say, I've thought fire, I mean, Hansi Wilson make a comment about, I spent my life preparing for fire and it came.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him saying that.
Yeah.
And so I felt, okay, I know this is going to come someday, I'm going to prepare for it, but
yeah.
I never thought it'd come like that.
Right.
I thought I'd be down in Sycamore Camp. I always thought I'd have time.
Yeah.
So you never know. It was like a perfect storm of bad luck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When it happened, how it happened.
Right.
You know, the year it happened, I mean the month that it happened.
Time of year,
yeah. You know, all that. So, and that's it is a global warming event.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that.
Yeah.
That's a factor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
How many?
But it was a stroke of, but it was also, for the rest of the family, it was, there was a, I won't say perfect storm, but there really wasn't a way of good luck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Chevy was here, Jolly was here. They found the pump,
mm-hmm.
You know, they were able to get, Angus was here,
mm-hmm.
They were all here, they might not have been,
right?
You know, and
they
were able to save,
yeah.
And they would have saved all those houses.
Yeah.
And as much as, how major thing this is for us, just think if we lost all those houses too.
Yeah.
I mean, had my mother-in-law, and my sister, two sisters-in-law, my brother-in-law, all out in the street,
yeah.
Instead of just us,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It would have been
infinitely harder.
Oh, infinitely harder.
Yeah.
So that's a godsend to the thing.
Mm-hmm. You, in your time in Big Sur, you've gone through many events like this, including major landslides, fires. Of course, but fires are the most destructive for people's private properties. But all the landslides also have been a big sort of incursion into our lives on the coast. Talk a little bit about those events. Are there some that stand out in your memory?
The slides?
Well, you know, events of that kind of nature that have impacted the community in a very unusual, I think. Most people don't live like we do with road closures for months and devastating destruction like the fire in 13 and 8 as well.
Yeah,
Rat Creek fire was a big one, and
yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, it's just part of being here. It's that's gotten even more difficult to deal with. I mean, this is all these changes. I mean, now if it's a rock in the road, they close the highway, you know, and then they just, you know, we just drive around it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, because of liability and.
Right.
Now Caltrans does go out at night, and they used to go out at night when there's all kind. You used to be able to. We were more isolated. I think Bob Skiles' comment is the best one, which I repeated. Is that he said that in his day, and really still when we came early, you know, in the even in the 60s, is that it used to be that you change your life. You had to change your life to be here. Now you can bring it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest change.
Right.
With VCRs and satellite TV and internet and all this stuff, now you don't have to make that sacrifice anymore. Now you're not as isolated.
Right.
That's a loss, that feeling, that isolation, that kind of man apart feeling.
Yeah.
That this culture, our world is.
Right.
It's a change.
Yeah. It's a choice we can still make, but you're right.
I don't know. I mean, you can't, yeah.
No,
I mean, how many people you know that would never have a phone have them now?
Right, right.
Don't you remember? Just got to survive, you know, it's part of living.
I'm also thinking about, do you remember back in 85, 86, I think it is. Is it 86? When I first got my computer, which was a Mac 512, you know, little box like this. And it was very exciting to be able to write letters on this thing and do a little bit of bookkeeping or whatever, you know, in the early days. How many people there were, many, many, many people, friends of ours, who said, never will I ever touch one of these computers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they became completely ubiquitous. Everyone, you know, has to use them.
I don't know what you do about, you know, people used to have good handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
They don't anymore.
No.
I mean, I have terrible handwriting, but I'm just saying that was part of how you communicated.
Yeah.
So you had that tactile,
mm-hmm,
thing of doing that. That's a loss. I mean, the trade-off, that's a loss.
Yes.
You're gaining something, but you're gaining something. I don't know what you're always gaining.
Right.
You know, it's like in a farm, you know, if you had a 2-plow plow tractor, you'd take you so long to do something. Well, your neighbor had a 4-plow or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get on the bigger one with the bigger plow,
mm-hmm,
you don't want to get on the little one again.
Right.
No.
Yeah,
weird.
I know.
And that guy, you know, the farmer next to us, he grew up when they pulled plows with horses.
Mm-hmm.
This old-time farmer.
Right.
He said he was less tired in a day, 14 hours in a day, walking behind a plow with a horse than he was 8 hours on a tractor. And of course, and you think, well, because the reason for that is, you think about it, the tractor is an unnatural,
right,
piece of machinery. Well, especially those tractors, you know, they're loud and they're bouncing and all this. Now, they've gone to the total other extreme. They put these cabs over the tractor, and there's soundproofing, and there's air conditioning, and you have music. So you're totally out of connection,
right,
with the ground.
Yes.
And the old ones, you know, you if you hear a little sound, you know, a little nuts loose on your plow, so you go back and fix it.
Right.
You're really connected, right?
Yeah.
So is that a gain or is that a loss, or is all we're getting out of it is we can feed more people?
Yeah.
And so we're still just as busy and still as heck, and we're not gaining any leisure. Supposedly we're gaining leisure, but I don't see anybody gaining leisure from all this.
No.
You know what I mean?
On the contrary.
That's
not
the idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
So Big Sur has sort of symbolized for many that kind of back to nature philosophy, starting with the early artists and then the hippies and back to nature people. Big Sur has symbolized that for a lot of people on the outside,
yeah,
when they,
yeah,
look in. Right? And now that's being lost a little.
Well, I know. I mean, it's, yeah. It's, I've had this problem with the whole, you know, land use, and, you know, to me, a building should not detract from the land.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm finding that less and less of value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I never thought of this at the time, but I have to, of all the construction that's gone around here, including our own, you know, I'm thinking, and that this one ridge across from us, all three houses on this one ridge going down are designed by Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on one of them.
Right.
And I used to think, God, this guy is—he's job security for carpenters, you know, because
so
everything's current. It's current. It's just wacko. A guy was born in a washing machine. But all of those buildings, actually, they don't detract.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Compared to so many others.
Yeah.
And my hat's really off to him.
Yeah.
For having that
aesthetic,
yeah, and we don't. And once you start doing these, you know, the houses that are for more for impression,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
than anything,
right?
You know,
mm-hmm,
it's, but not that I mean, look at Hanley's. When Hanley's was the Coastlands, it was a big stink because it's multi-story. It's a big, ugly-looking thing, according to Skiles and everybody, compared to what you could have.
Right, right.
You're never going to, I mean, it's hard to, anyway.
What do you think, I mean, this is not something I usually talk about, but I know that's something that you've been expressing sentiments about. And I think being right here in your neighborhood, with your family living nearby, but new homes, like we just spoke of, being rebuilt, some of them being sold to new people, I believe, right now on the ridge right here.
Mm.
Right. Or have just being sold, having been sold since the fire.
Been sold, but no building on it. They're going to, the ones that I know of,
like ships.
The buildings are gone. Yeah, they're going to build something
new. Exactly,
right.
That's what I mean. Yeah, so new things are going to come up. So interesting, or you know, who knows what's going to happen. What the question is simply, if the short-term rental situation is such that it becomes legal, so that people would have short-term rentals in maybe half of the buildings up here, what would that mean, do you think, for this part of Pfeiffer Ridge?
Well, it'd be another step down that road that would diminish our experience.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, you know, like we're saying, it's a different kind of community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is not healthy.
Right. Right.
I think.
No.
You know, unless you live in the city or something. Well, it's all. But it's good for. Look what this would mean to us. Look, think what we could rent this on SCR.
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, we're living out of the bank and Social Security.
Yeah.
It's, I have to work very hard to make sure that we are living within our means.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wouldn't have to worry about that.
No. Right.
Oh, man. Hot dog.
Yeah.
Hog heaven.
Yeah.
But it's a very, the only thing is my immediate world and maybe the friends I have on Facebook, you know,
right.
Whatever, you know, it's
yeah.
not like it's no more,
yeah.
It's higher. It's really weird too, you know, when you think about it, we, you know, back in the day,
mm-hmm.
here we are,
yeah,
just
yeah.
like all these old freaking old timers,
yeah,
what
yeah.
my day?
yeah.
yeah, I mean, we used to do all our own maintenance. We had people here that did maintenance. They called Big Sur Construction, or they called whatever.
Right.
Now they have these people drive down from town.
Yes.
Fix
right.
a refrigerator, fix this or that. They think nothing of it.
Right.
You get the service guy.
Yeah.
You know.
I just met a couple coming down, in fact. Some contractor that came from Marina. Yeah. Anyway. But people are building homes that have all those amenities installed, central heating and central air conditioning and all of those things that require, it's like your cars. I mean, it's the same thing with a car in a way, right? It used to be so easy to work on your car, but it's not so easy anymore if something happens with the engine.
Well, now you know why I've got a 45-year-old vehicle.
Exactly.
Where
I know.
I can take it apart from one end to the other.
Yeah, yeah.
Every bolt, every nut, every part I know.
Exactly. In a way, I wish I still had my old Dodge Power Wagon for that reason. But that's the same thing that happens with our homes. They become more and more complex.
Well, sure, they got refrigerators have motherboards in them, or
right.
you know, chipboards, whatever they call them. Yeah, they all have that.
Specialized.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. God, I got a camera. You know, I had to. One thing about this is, that's another thing that's been a real challenge. You know, replacing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's insurance money for it. I'm at a point in my life when less is more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yet I've got it. So I have to replace things.
Yeah.
I have to go out and buy things.
Right. right.
That was hard. That was hard at first.
Yeah. Have you replaced some of you? Have you replaced?
Better at.
Some of your tools, have you replaced them?
I've had to because I need them.
Right, sure. That's what I mean. Yeah.
But I just replaced my camera. The only thing about it, I got to say, is that, I mean, I have tools that are 20 years old, 30
yeah.
years old, right? I mean,
right.
The drill press, for example. So I replaced it with a new one, right?
Yeah.
Well, you get the latest. See, when you replace something, you get the latest with all the nice changes.
Right.
There's a little bonus there.
Yeah.
Because it's got a laser X that shows right where the bit's supposed to go.
Uh-huh. right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's kind of neat. That's fun. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, wow. And then I replaced I had a 20D Canon, and I was taking pictures of Celia's artwork with it, and then she ends up getting them done in town. So, but anyway, and I like photography, and I like the extra, the dealing with, depth of field and all that.
Right.
But anyway, so I finally decided, okay, because the insurance company will replace something you lost.
Right.
If it's a 20D and the current one's an 80D, they'll pay for it.
Right.
If you don't, they'll give you the depreciated amount.
Yeah.
You want to talk? You should see this book. We have 100 pages of stuff that we listed and priced.
Wow.
A huge job.
Right.
Huge job. Yeah, there's like 4,000 items in there. So he says.
Uh-huh. How long do
that
you
took
have?
Forever.
Now, how long do you have in the future? How long will the insurance company be willing to pay?
The way it works is you give them they give you some money to start with to buy stuff, and then at least this is with State Farm. And then once you turn in material list that either stuff you replaced or stuff you had with pricing on it. Then once they write you the first check from that, then you have a year to complete the whole process.
I see.
They just did that with us.
Right.
So I was really worried because we don't have any place to put stuff like furniture.
Right.
So
the timing is important.
Yeah. Yeah. So that works out.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got this AED and it is incredible.
Right.
It is so fast.
Yeah.
And the focusing is like that.
Yes.
It's amazing camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sharp. I took pictures at the memorial up there.
Yeah. With
it.
Right.
There's hardly any that you want to throw out. I mean,
right.
It's really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of a treat.
They can sort of think they can almost think for you sometimes, the cameras. They're so good.
They have so many options on it. I mean, not only that, I mean, you take video with Garrett's camera recital, the guy was using a camera for the video.
Right.
Sort of video
right.
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing machine.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
Did you ever hunt?
No.
Fish? No. You fished?
A little bit.
Uh-huh.
When I was in college and then.
Here?
No.
No.
No, I never. I mean, I went. Yeah, I didn't do much fishing.
You went out with Wayne a couple of times? Or
No, it'd be trout fishing.
Right.
Stream fishing, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But now you never had a boat in the ocean?
No.
Right.
You?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. For a little while. I'm really looking forward to doing it again. It's just a matter, the challenge we have is access. Even though we have this beautiful ocean right here, you have to find a place where you can hide a boat.
Can't you do it? You can do it down at, where Newell's are down below. I mean, below Newell's, there's probably a place to get a boat in I'll think of it in a minute. Packard's property.
Yeah.
Right in there. Or,
yeah. I know. There are a couple of things I'm trying to. You know, it's a big thing to ask somebody though, to have access and to walk down or to even drive down. So there are a couple of places I know of, and the one place I had before was through Joe Hudson, and that was a fantastic place where I had my boat.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hoping to maybe do that again.
Because always you gotta go down a Willow Creek or something, don't you?
Exactly. It's too far away. I mean,
yeah.
It's like playing
yeah.
golf.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm telling you that.
So I love, but I love the idea of filling up my freezer, once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's such nice fish.
Yeah,
yeah,
that sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, Mark Seafelt, fishes. He used to. In fact, he even was got a job with I don't know, Forster or something, keeping track of people down at Willow Creek.
Uh-huh.
Really take out.
Yeah.
But he and his son, David, they love to fish. They fish.
Do you know where they go out?
I think it's down there.
Uh-huh, right. Big Creek is another place,
Well, that'd be pretty close to them. I wonder if that'd be closer to Lucia than
Yeah, and there's nothing. There's also the. I had a little kayak for a short while. I shared it with somebody. I can't remember now, but I launched. That was when Frank and Kathy were at Las Rocas.
Uh-huh.
That trail, you know, going down.
Uh-huh.
There's a little boat down there that I used also for a little while. Long time ago. That must have been back in the 80s. But it's always the access challenge. Also, you know, in order not to disturb, I always dreamt of making a secret trail down, down right behind the mailboxes on Partington. Because there's definitely places down there, but it's just such a, it's a fairly long way. And I also know that it's I know Kevin Southall, I think, did it once. But it just, you can't hide it. If you're going to use it, you're not going to be able to hide it. You know? And if it's not hidden, it's going to be, you know.
Tourists are going to use it for a bathroom.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Man. No, I never did. Frank, and actually he had, went up to Cedar's Cabin this last week, and Vince Torres was there. He's 92. He used to hunt with Sam.
Hopkins. Yeah.
And Frank, I mean, they did that, all big hunters in those days.
Right.
And they go to Massacre Ridge. You know Massacre, you heard of that, Massacre Ridge?
No.
Yeah, it's a little bit, I think it's on the other side of Cold Springs, right in that area.
Okay.
And they go up there, and they drive, get up real early, and they get up there, and they hunt, they shoot doves.
Oh, yeah. Because
the doves fly from one place to another, anyway, they
right.
go across there.
Yeah.
You just go dove hunting there.
Massacre
Ridge, they call it. Yeah.
Sam used to do a lot of dove hunting.
Yeah. Well, he would go with Vince, one of the guys that went with him.
Yeah,
he knew Sam very well.
You never did that with those guys?
No, I was, right.
I don't think Helmut did either, right? Mm-mm. No, not, it wasn't the thing to do here.
Yeah, this one's a little bit different, really. They're more the, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly never had, myself, had any yearning for that myself.
I don't think Helmut was a fan of, not, well, I knew him from when he was pretty young, so. More part of the bohemian.
Right.
Tints, you know,
yeah.
not the
right, yeah, the macho.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Thanks, Ray.
Well, thank you. It's fun talking to you.
Yeah, so much. So your wife is coming home. We have to charge. Yeah.
You see her?
Yep.